Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. It's good to understand the project that I always talk about, like the project of Buddhism, because we have Buddha offers all kinds of suggestions, and if you don't really understand what the project is, they're just experiences which are puzzling or pleasant or whatever, but they're not part of a whole piece. So if you understand the project or you have a sense of it, then all the pieces should fit. All the teachings should fit, the practices should fit. So the teaching is often, as you read in the text, the Buddha often says to teach suffering in its end. Or another more strange way to say that is to teach the world and the end of the world. And so the kind of suffering that he was talking about was the kind of suffering that we as human beings experience internally. He wasn't talking about the suffering of Hurricane Sandy or the suffering of cholera or the kind of external, environmental, physical things that we experience. Those are for other areas of science or medicine to deal with. But what he was talking about was our own hearts and our own minds, and that we do have a possibility of realizing peace, and that that's something that's available to us at all times, actually. And when we suffer, that the Buddha would say that, I mean, our teaching says certainly there are external factors which we have to deal with. So if we don't have a coat on, we're going to freeze to death, and if we don't have food, we're going to starve to death, and so on. So there are external factors, but leaving those aside, if we suffer internally, then there's something which we don't understand. So the cause of suffering is ignorance, not seen clearly. And ignorance isn't here a lack of IQ, more it's a lack of really seeing life as it is, seeing things clearly, understanding the nature of things. So it's rather like not understanding the law of gravity and stepping off a roof and falling and breaking your leg. It's a kind of ignorance. It seems silly to us that, of course, you wouldn't step off a roof. You intuitively know. You know that gravity pulls you down and you get hurt. But there's a lot of things that we function from, a lot of attitudes and mindsets, emotions that are programmed into us for various reasons, which are ignorant. They misread things. They miscalculate. They misdirect us. And so we function from these misunderstandings. And so it's clearing up these understandings that's a very important part of is really the heart of Buddhism, is right understanding. And then when we have right understanding, then we incline our minds with right thought to cultivate the mind to live a social life which leads to peace, which is a foundation for peace. So right understanding is really what directs our meditation, our social life, everything we do, really. So ignorance and the dispelling of ignorance are paramount and central to Buddhist teachings. I was reading about, we were talking about this on breakfast time, about a program that exists with the American military to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder for people coming from Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's a kind of virtual reality situation where the men who are coming from these two wars are there. Many of them are into talking therapies, and they're more into video games. So what they've done is they've created a headset that has visual stimuli, olfactory stimuli, audio stimuli, and also smells and physical shaking. So the senses have a chance to be stimulated. And of course, what they do is they put the helmet on the ex-soldier, and they bring him into Baghdad, and then they can bring up a video of a marketplace with Arab talk, or they can have an explosion of an LED right by the road. And it's interesting, the situation is such that they have this capsule, I suppose, it's shaking, so it feels like a Humvee or like a tank. And then they can have the smell of gunpowder. And so they're able to actually create the situation which stimulates the trauma of these soldiers. And the idea here is that these soldiers are so caught in this post-traumatic stress disorders that when they, like the example they gave of one fellow who, he's come back home, he's living with his family, and they're driving on the road to the shopping center, and he sees a plastic bag on the road, and he grabs his wife's steering wheel. He says he's afraid to drive now. He grabs the steering wheel off his wife to take her away from the bag because he thinks it's a bomb. He's just so programmed. He's so programmed with this stress because his mind's been so stressed out. And so what they do is they put these ex-soldiers, military people into this environment. They actually stimulate this memory so that the memory becomes more normalized and they're able to be objective to it and aware of it, and so that they don't believe in it and they don't just blindly follow it and react to it. So the skill of the therapist is paramount, because if you give too much of this kind of stimuli, the person just re-traumatizes and goes back into that. And they seem to be fairly successful with this. It's hell on earth for these poor fellows. But they begin to be aware. They begin to be aware of this as memory, even though the memory has a somatic, has a physical feeling, it has a hallucinatory quality to it. But through the exposure to it and the therapist telling them, you're here now, this is just a video, they begin to, through that long exposure, begin to have mindfulness around these things. So where am I going with this? Well, I think memory is obviously a very powerful part of human existence. So if we don't understand memory, then of course there's a certain level of ignorance there that conditions us, and so we react to life through that ignorance. There's memory, but there's also remembering. And remembering, like deliberate remembering, is still a function of memory, but deliberately remembering something is something that we can introduce through skill. So I might have a memory of, let's say, I have an argument with someone half an hour before the sitting. And, I have a disagreement, and I say something or they say something, and it just kind of one of those difficult situations. And then I come into the sitting, the memory comes up, and maybe that memory, and I get lost into it. So I shouldn't have said that, or it wasn't fair that they said that. And my attention gets lost in the memory through a sense of self, which I like to call a psychological self. So there's a sense of a person being born into the world of my inner world, into my subjective world. And that's memory when it's bound up by ignorance. I don't see that this is just stimuli, conditioned phenomena, creating this emotion and creating a sense of psychological self. I don't notice that as an object. I become the subject, and I suffer. Not only do I suffer just that, and it's not like war trauma, obviously, but it is a form of agitation which is not peaceful, and more profoundly than that, it also prevents me from realizing the deep possibility that the Buddha pointed to, which lies in the present moment when we are not preoccupied and we're not distracted. So there's sort of a double problem there. The problem is I just suffer from maybe aversion or self-aversion or aversion to that person. And if I'm not careful, I just repeat that I shouldn't have been like that. It's not fair. They shouldn't be like that. So that's a kind of low-level sense of suffering. So that's one problem. And the other problem, my mind is preoccupied. And that very preoccupation prevents me from seeing the profundity of the end of suffering, which the Buddha pointed to. Because I can't. I'm caught up with this old memory. So that's memory conjoined with ignorance. Remembering skillfully, then, if I make a suggestion in the beginning of my meditation that present moment awareness, I say that to myself as a strong intention. Now, why do I say that? Well, because of some understanding I have, right understanding, hopefully. And the right understanding, well, why? And right intention is, again, dependent on right understanding. If I'm just doing things because the teacher says, the book says, it seems like a good idea or so on. If I don't really have the heartfelt insight, then the intention won't really have much staying power. It'll just be a kind of clever idea. So certainly in popular culture, when you hear about things, oh yes, be in the present moment, be here now. So it's a kind of popular idea. But it doesn't necessarily stick. I can read that, and I can say, oh, yeah, probably a good idea. Then I'll notice more birds, I'll probably taste the blueberries more. Yeah, be present. But it doesn't, it's just a sort of kind of someone else's nice idea, perhaps. Whereas with right understanding, if I understand something, I have the insight into it, I see the profundity of it, I see the importance of it, then my mind is going to say, no, I must do that. That's important. I must incline my mind that way. So why is present moment awareness important? Why is that important? Well, it comes back to several things. One is just the more mundane aspect that much of our suffering is just habitual. Much of our inner lack of peace is just bad habit. And not awakening to that reinforces that bad habit. So it might be just like low-level aversion, just fantasizing about stuff, planning all the time. And there's nothing grossly wrong about that, but if you're interested in like the deep peace of the mind, if you're interested in like a spiritual aspiration, then that becomes more and more untenable. That's just not appropriate. That's just not where it's at. And you can become more, you see how much, how that limits you, just the forces of mental habits. So there's a kind of urgency that arises. That's not the way to go. I've been through that cycle of self-disparagement 6 million times, or I've been through this fascination with a fridge too many times, or I've been through this judgment of someone. You just get fed up with it, basically. There's just something about it. No, I want to move on. I want to realize something more profound and more different. So there's a kind of urgency arises, and you see, these habits of mind that I get preoccupied with are unworthy, are ignoble, and they do not lead to peace. So there's that kind of very human becoming a better person part of it. But more deeply than that, also, if you contemplate the project, is that the Buddha does point to some way of consciousness, which is the words we use, which I use often, are something which is profoundly different than experience, than our normal experience. So we say it's unconditioned, it's unoriginated, it's not a matter of time, it's here and now, it's deathless, it's peace, it's nibbana, it's the island, it's the refuge. We have this language that the Buddha used, both as metaphors and pointers to a possibility. And the Buddha's project is to realize that possibility. It's not just a psychological readjustment so I can go to the marketplace and my wife can drive and I don't freak out when we go to the marketplace. That would be a step on the way if one was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. But one of the things we discussed when we were discussing this in the morning was that a psychological rearrangement to better health is definitely a good thing and a necessary thing, but what's the goal? What's the point of that? Is it simply just to be a better adjusted person and a kind of functioning member of society that votes for a certain party and so on? Well, certainly that would be a part of it, but the Buddha's enlightenment is more than that, obviously. It's much, much more than that. It's more than just being a kind of good socially adjusted person. And the interest in that, the curiosity about that and the inclination towards that comes in various ways, through one's readings, through meeting teachers, through one's own profound experiences of silence. You know, you begin to intuit a possibility, I think. And maybe that's why we're here. So the sense of going back to, well, what's the importance of present moment awareness? Well, present moment awareness is the only thing we have, actually. You know, past and the future you can't really know them. You can only know the past as a memory, and you can only know the future as an anticipation. There is only the present moment as experience, as chronological time, sure, that exists, and so on, but as experience, there is only the present moment. And there's something about holding the mind in the present moment, sustaining present moment awareness, and not getting lost in the sense of time that opens the gates to that possibility. So it's very important. It's very, very important. And then seeing that, having a sense of that, creates right intention. Then I say, I really must do that. I must train in that way in my meditation, in my life, because one understands that. The whole sense of time is an important consideration, because sense of time also is a sense of self. When you observe how the ego works in consciousness, you see, like if I make an intention, present moment awareness, in my meditation, I make that a really strong intention, then very quickly, having made that intention, I'll notice how I'm arguing about with the person that I had the argument half an hour ago. I'll see the sense of self arising, and it'll act like a brilliant mirror for the sense of self. Or if I'm planning something in the future and I'm getting caught in that, I just keep saying present moment awareness, I'll see this whole sense of a self in the future, this psychological self being born and dying. And so what that intention does, it begins to objectify the subjective. Okay, so this is what the Buddha was trying to do, I think, what our teaching is trying to do, is trying to take our subjective experience. Each of us has a subjective experience of this room. You're each hearing a different thing. You're each feeling something different. The temperature of your body's different. The memories are coming and going are different. So each of us, although we're in the same room and you're listening to the same person, each of you has a different experience. Each of you perceives me in a different way. My hand gestures affect you in a different way. My voice affects you in a different way. So each of us has a very subjective experience of this present moment. Can't be any other way, right? And what the teaching is trying to do is trying to make, the subjective experience more objective. In other words, trying to see, you become the observer of your subjective experience rather than be the subject. So in other words, if you begin in the meditation, present moment awareness, make that really strong intention, and the memory comes up of the argument you had a half an hour ago, you will tend to be more objective to that. You tend to notice that as an object. Oh, that's thought, or that's memory. If you don't make that intention and you just let habit kind of go on and on and on, then you tend to become the subject of that memory, right? So I have the encounter with someone, and it's fractious, and then the memory comes up, and then because I'm not aware, oh, it shouldn't have been like that, I shouldn't have done that, and then the bell rings and the meditation's over. So that's being the subject, isn't it? And then the teaching is introducing ways, methods, where you wake up to this whole subjective quality as an object. This is an object, this is a feeling, this is a memory, this is a version. And that awakening is in the present moment. In the present moment. And as you do that, you begin to see this movement of self, psychological self, through time, it can always be known in the present moment. So chronological time comes and goes, but the present moment awareness is timeless. It's always timeless. That's all you really have. And so cultivating that, the awareness of your subjective world no longer pulls you. You no longer get trapped and preoccupied because you know, well, that's just memory. Memories. So you take the extreme case of the poor fellow from the war who has these awful, awful, awful memories. Through constant awakening and the therapist saying, that's just a memory, he begins, well, that's just a memory. He becomes objective to this awful subjective memory that he has to endure. Still, I'm sure it's still very awful and probably never ends in his life, but what ends, maybe, to some extent, is attachment. And that's what we mean by attachment. It's this getting caught up with, preoccupied with, grasping, attaching to memory, thought, feeling, sense of self, psychological self, time, I am someone, going somewhere, becoming something, and so on. And all of that preoccupation misses the point. We are no longer, we're not available. We're not available to the transcendent, to the deathless, to that which is always kind of, it's apparent here and now, we say, not a matter of time. But as we become objective, you know, it's just memory, even though it's a painful memory, even though it's a hurtful memory and all of that, it still has its qualities. We begin to have a kind of witnessing center, which says, no, that's thought. And so the sense of psychological self no longer dominates or dominates less. So we become more available, we become more free. And from that kind of freedom, What we have a possibility actually of inquiry. As long as we are caught in this kind of subjective experience of self, there's no chance of seeing anything new or fresh. You know, we're just caught in the old cycles and the old memories and the old sense of self. And all of us have been through the boringness of it, right? This kind of endless blah, blah, blah. There it goes again. Oh, God, are you there again? You know, just be quiet up there. And then we try to get rid of things. You know, we try to shut up, will you? Will you please leave me alone? But that doesn't work either because it's still a sense of self. You know, I'm someone who's fed up with my thoughts now. So then we can go. We can kind of bounce around between being obsessed by thoughts and then hating thoughts. But there's no awareness in that. Well, the awareness is the waking up to thought as thought, feeling as feeling, memory as memory, bodily sensation as bodily sensation. This is just memory. And just to be able to do that, to say this is just a memory, even if it's a really awful memory, you strike the pose of enlightenment, actually. This is right understanding. You understand that this is memory. This is just memory. It's right understanding. So if that present moment awareness can be encouraged. Now, if you just take that as your project this year, not next year, 2013, you can do it for this year too, but if you up the ante, make it 12 months. If that's all we did, and be moral, I assume all of that present moment bank robbery, right? I'm assuming we're kind of, this is graduate school rather than, so, you know, just if you just make that intention, present moment awareness, how powerful that would be. But you'd have to do it. And why would I do it? Because I see the importance of it. I see, I understand the importance of that. Now if I did that, and I really trained in that, then I'd be training my mind. And in training that, as I abide more and more in the present moment, I can begin to see where my intentions are unskillful, where my intentions are bound by hatred or bound by self-aversion, or bound by rationalizing negative behavior, or bound by distractedness, or whatever. I can see those intentions, bound by greed, hatred, and delusion, I begin to know them in the present moment. I see the tension of them. I see that the suffering of them. So present moment awareness awakens me to actually what's going on in my mind. Memory is this is not just a memory coming up because of habit. Now this is remembering. And when we talk about awareness or sati, that's one of the ways we talk about that. It's recollecting. You recollect the present moment. You remember the present moment. So it's not just when we talk about awareness, satipatthana. We don't. It's not just about, again, being careful and not spilling the soup on the floor or something like that. It's more profound than that. So what can we recollect? What can we recollect? We can only recollect, first of all, if we are in the present moment. And then the Buddha asks us to recollect change. And I think I was speaking about that last time, but to actually bring up the what we call anicca sanya, recollection of change. Now, that is a very, very, very skillful thing to do. As Buddhists, we're always being encouraged, you know, this, it's changing and life is impermanent and it's uncertain. As a kind of Buddhist, just a kind of Buddhist position, right? And Buddhists believe in change. It's changing. Ha ha ha. I'm getting old. But actually, to bring up the perception of change is a much more rigorous kind of meditation or recollection. So we try to do this in meditation, having established present moment awareness and getting really good at that. Get really, really good at that first. Then, because now we're available, we're no longer preoccupied, we're available, we're in the present moment, we can bring up, okay, how does this change? What's the changing nature? Now, if I can hold attention on change, at first it's a kind of nebulous, what does he mean? What does he mean by change? Because we're looking for some experience called change. We think that maybe that if I see change, I'll get enlightened. So then we start to look for enlightenment. But actually, things are always changing. Bodily feelings, thoughts, emotions. And to be the witness of change means you have to step back. You can't be just in there trying to get something. You have to step back. You have to be aloof. You have to be detached. You have to have practice non-attachment. So this is the method for practicing non-attachment, is to notice change, recollect change. If I'm not in the present moment, if I'm caught up with stuff, it can't happen. I'm not available. So then I bring up that recollection, present moment awareness, and I bring up, okay, how do things change? Now to do that, to notice change, I cannot get attached. I have to let things just be the way they are. I have to just let them run their course. And so I want breath changing, bodily changing, thoughts coming and going. And as you do that, as you get good at that, then what happens is the sense of a doer begins to be attenuated. It begins to die away. The sense of me doing something to get something, that sense of ego or self begins to fall away, and the mind begins to realize emptiness of self. Because the mind is now attentive to change rather than being an ego caught up with change, with desire and memory and all of that. So the entry into emptiness, or the taste of emptiness, which is a kind of important part of Buddhist training, comes about through sustained non-grasping, sustained non-identification, sustained non-ego, just knowing change, things changing. Now you have to be able to sustain that for the mind to begin to feel that emptiness. And when we talk about emptiness, we don't talk about emptiness in terms of vacuity and nothing's happening. It's just the sense of ego self is not there. There's just a sense of presence. There's still a sense of presence, but there isn't that quality of me doing something to become something. And these are the kind of signposts and foundations for the deeper peace of the mind, deeper liberation of the mind. So if we don't, if we're always caught up with memory, if we're always caught up with thoughts of me, past and future, then there's, you know, we're not really in the ball game. If we understand that present moment awareness is terribly important, we'll make the intention. If we make that intention, we create a foundation for presence. When we have that foundation of presence, there's more peacefulness in the mind. The habits of negativity and so on don't exacerbate, don't get worse. But also, we begin to be able to introduce really skillful reflections. And if we can hold attention on this is changing, it begins to take you to the silence and emptiness of the mind. Now, if you can do that in a meditation, what happens, like in a meditation, you do that for 45 minutes here, that creates a very powerful momentum in consciousness. This is the interesting thing about meditation, is because the intentional aspect of it, if it's done clearly and with strength and with rigor, that creates this incredible momentum that you begin to remember that all day. You begin to remember present moment awareness all day, and you begin to remember that recollection, oh, this is changing. So hopefully then, you get caught up with that same person again, and now the argument just is sort of second inning, starts up again. But now, you know, you've put the intent, present moment awareness, and maybe you notice like, oh, this is changing, and you step back from it. You're the witness to this heat or opinionatedness or whatever, and you don't grasp it so much. You don't grab it because your mind has been trained towards non-grasping, and that will affect the discussion you've had, which will affect the way you come to the next meditation. So the intentions that we make in meditation are very, very powerful. They really have a long-lasting effect if they're done skillfully, because we're not doing anything else. Our intentions aren't sort of like, we're not like cooking and driving, and not that you cook and drive together. You know, you're doing one thing. And just that one thing, if you just present moment awareness, you'll see it play out all day. And that's why we kind of reinforce these things in a meditation. So it's not just about the meditation. It's about mindfulness and recollection throughout the day. So that becomes more and more powerful in your life. And then you really do see how the sense of self gets born, the psychological self gets born through fantasy, through memory, through self-hatred, through criticism and judgment of others and outrage or whatever you want. It just keeps getting reborn into the mind. You say, oh, that's just a thought. And it's tremendous freedom, just that, not to be the victim of all these things. So I would encourage that kind of intention, if you can see the importance of intention, how powerful intention is, and that's what really trains us, and to make that intention towards both present moment awareness and the perception of change. Those are very, very, very fundamental to a Buddhist practice. Okay, I'll leave that for reflection.
And my own Dhamma Kataya Sadhu Karanga Dhamma Se.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.